Greetings from our Cattlecast studio in Lansing, Michigan. I'm Mark Bazita, and welcome to the first episode of 2019. Today we'll be speaking with one of the top voiceover artists in the country, a David Letterman super fan, and hear about a new film about the late Aretha Franklin. We'll get started right after this.
Right here.
Life can get pretty busy between work, family, friends, and running all those errands. But with the Cattle app, life gets a little easier. It allows you to download or stream books, movies, music, and more on your mobile device anytime with a library card. Capital Area District Libraries. Everything right here.
Right here.
Download the Cattle app today.
The National Football League presents the Bridgestone Super Bowl 44 Halftime Show. Live from Radio City Music Hall, it's the American Theater Wing's 63rd Annual Tony Awards. Monday, August 30th, it's Entertainment Tonight at the Emmys.
My next guest is the preeminent voiceover artist in America and the first woman to announce the Academy Awards and the Emmy Awards. Her resume also includes the Super Bowl and the 2018 Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. Randy Thomas, welcome to the Cattlecast Podcast.
Thank you, Mark. It's a pleasure to be here.
So share with us the path that you took in becoming a voiceover artist.
Wow. Well, for me, I happen to be from Michigan, from Oak Park outside Detroit. And I was a kid who wanted to act. So I, you know, jumped into every play that I could with community theater, went to New York, studied to be an actor, realized in New York, where everyone is super talented, that can sing and dance and do all of that, I realized my talents were a little limited. And I went back to Michigan from New York, and I was still a kid. I was like 19, and I found my way into a radio station. It was by chance that it happened. And that's what started my career as a broadcaster. And from that, then obviously voiceover came through that.
And earlier in your career, who did you look up to in the industry?
Wow. Well, you know, I was the first woman to announce the Academy Awards, Emmy Awards, the Tony Awards, Kennedy Center Honors, Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. I was also one of the first women on the air in radio. And so growing up as a kid that put a transistor next to my ear, listening to WDRQ or, of course, CKLW, that was... those were my heroes, those kinds of DJs, you know, the great disc jockeys of America were who I admired. And they were almost all men. There were very few women to look up to, except for one, and her name was Allison Steele. And she was on WNEW in New York, and I believe she was pretty much one of the first women in radio.
Now, generally, how do you secure and complete voiceover jobs?
Well, I have an agent. I have Atlas Talent, who has offices in New York and Los Angeles. When buyers are looking to hire me, they reach out to my agents, occasionally through personal relationships, having been in the business for a long time. People will reach out to me directly, but everything goes through my agents. That's how I get booked. That's how they secure my schedule.
And now in 2008, you wrote the book called Voice for Hire, which provided tips on launching and maintaining a career in voiceovers. What ways has the industry changed since the release of your book?
Well, the industry continues to change, but one of the biggest changes that came about and why I wrote the book is that there are tens of thousands of people with a microphone, a USB, and a laptop that want to learn how to do voiceover. And that continues today. When I first started as a voiceover artist, it was limited pretty exclusively to union talents in New York, Chicago, LA, San Francisco, you know, major markets is where most of the talent were. And now we know that they are many, and they are all over the world, and they would all like to take my jobs.
Well, and speaking of books, have you ever provided narration for an audiobook?
I actually did. Sadly, my best friend, her name was Debbie Ford, and she was an inspirational leader to many in the self-help world. And she wrote a book called Your Holiness, and she passed away. And then they found this manuscript that she wrote, which is a prayer book, essentially. And so 5 years after her death, I got to read the book called Your Holiness by Debbie Ford. And it's on audiobook. And I'm really, really grateful for that opportunity.
Absolutely. Well, let's talk about what an Oscar night is like. Where are you positioned in relation to the stage? And how do the cues and the announcements get addressed from you to over the air?
Well, the Oscars are an incredible show, one of the biggest in the world. When we are doing the Oscars in February, the way that the Dolby Theater has been laid out, the entire show takes place within the theater. But those of us in the production crew were actually located outside of the theater in various trucks and whatnot. So I'm speaking into a microphone, watching it essentially on TV like everyone at home, and they're cueing me in my headset telling me when to speak. And I have a script in front of me, of course, so I stay on page and I wait for my cues.
And so when the envelope is opened and the name is announced, that's the first time you're hearing it as well. So you have to be prepared for, you know, four or five possible names.
Well, hello. What have we learned from 2 years ago? That yes, indeed, we do not know the correct answer until the envelope is opened on the air. And they've made sure that that faux pas will never happen again. There is now a third person from the accounting firm of PricewaterhouseCoopers that will sit with the director in his truck. And if the words that come out of the presenter's mouth are not correct, the director will shut it down right there. And we won't have that awkward thing that happened a couple of years ago.
Right. Tell us about your podcast.
Oh, thank you for asking. So I'm married a very long time. My husband used to be in the record promotion business, and I was a radio DJ. And together we have a show called The Music Connection Podcast. You can find us, just Google Music Connection Podcast on, or look for us in Apple, iTunes, wherever you listen to podcasts. We're also on Pandora now. And basically, we interview top music artists, some you haven't heard of yet because their star is on the rise, and also artists who have been well-known, like Daryl Hall and John Oates and many older artists that are still working today. So we have a podcast we drop every Wednesday, and this week is actually Brent Smith from Shinedown is our guest.
And where else can our listeners hear you?
Well, I am the voice of Nightline on ABC. So if I remember, a lot of my friends in Michigan, we're all early to bed people and early to rise. You may want to just DVR Nightline. It's on after Jimmy Kimmel, and listen to it or watch it in the daytime. The stories are phenomenal, and I'm very blessed. I'm the first woman in their 38-year history that is the voice behind the show.
Well, from the Academy Awards to Nightline, your career has done wonderful things and continued success in all that you do. And we look forward to hearing you in many more environments and award shows and all around the industry. Randy, thanks so much for joining us today on Cattlecast.
Thank you so much. Have a great day.
On May 20th, 2015, David Letterman said thank you and good night. The Foo Fighters sang Everlong, and Late Show with David Letterman ended its nearly 22-year run on CBS. The final 6 weeks of the series had guests like Julia Roberts, George Clooney, Oprah Winfrey, and the Obamas. All names you have heard many times, but it was the people behind the scenes who pulled off these 28 unforgettable episodes of late-night television. Author Scott Ryan has written a new book, The Last Days of Letterman, The Final 6 Weeks, where he conducted interviews with over 20 longtime staffers of David Letterman. Scott, welcome to Cattlecast.
Thanks for having me.
So
I have to say that hearing it again, that it ended after 22 years, broke my heart all over again.
Right. Well, let's talk about what are your favorite memories of watching David Letterman?
Well, the first memory that comes to mind is just the routine of it. I think that's what I miss the most, because I watch Dave every day since at least the early 90s. And it was my relaxation for the day. It was my time. And I just miss that Dave sitting at the desk, maybe telling a story about bumping into someone on the street or anything, just his banter with Paul. And those are the moments that I miss. Bigger moments would certainly be like the Christmas show. I feel like I really miss Darlene Love and all that they did for the Christmas show.
Absolutely. Now, did you ever see tapes of the early days of, you know, his late night show at NBC or anything like that?
Yeah, I used to watch it then as well. It wasn't a part of my everyday routine because I was still in high school. And it wasn't until we moved to CBS that I programmed the VCR to tape it every day. And that's when I started watching. I always feel like I'm a stalker when I say that. But you know, now we just hit a button on the DVR. It's no big deal. But I had to program it and everything.
Right.
I just love Dave.
Now, most of the people you spoke with for this book had never given interviews before. How did you get in touch with them, and how did they agree to speak with you?
Man, if I had the secret to that, I would be just pumping out books left and right. I mean, I don't know how it happened. I mean, luck is honestly how it happened. So it all started when I watched the final episode, and then the next day in the paper, I had read that Barbara Gaines, who was the executive producer, was the person that did the final montage with the Foo Fighters. And I was so curious about how that was done that I started tweeting Barbara and asking her for an interview. And it only took like a year and 6 months before she said yes. So, hey, no big deal. And then once I got Barbara Gaines, and she really could tell that I just wanted to capture a moment in history. It wasn't about personalities or gossip or that aspect. Then Barbara became the gatekeeper for me, and she just opened up those emails and would tell other people, hey, you should talk to this guy. He's working on a book. And so, you know, once you make that connection, that makes all the difference.
So what was the atmosphere like at the Ed Sullivan Theater those last 6 weeks as the show was winding down?
Well, that was the interesting part about doing all these interviews, because it was different for everyone. You know, like the writers, they were not maudlin at all. They were not looking back with nostalgia. They said that things were getting crazier and crazier, and they were like, they were getting loopy, and they were throwing balls around, bouncing them off the walls. And someone literally brought a helmet to work one day just to be safe. But then you can go to a different department where they said that it was just so sad. And like the HR lady who had to let all these people go and give them packages for, you know, I can't think of severance packages. For them, it was a very somber thing because you're working on people's insurance. I mean, it's the side of Dave leaving that you don't think about, that these people are losing their jobs.
Right.
So it depended who you talked to. I think, you know, for everyone, they had a different feeling.
So let's talk about one of the famous aspects from the show is the top 10 lists. And in your book, you learn a little bit about what goes into the writing of the top 10 list. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, I interviewed just a bit over half of the writers from the top 10. So there's a whole chapter in the book just about creating it. And you would think it's an easy bit. You have this topic and then you just have 10 jokes. But the amount of jokes that each writer had to write to get down to the 10 and have everyone agree to it. That was the hard part for them and frustrating, because all of them said, like, if I've written, you know, 15 jokes on what's going to make Britney Spears a good mom, I doubt my next 35 jokes are going to be better than my first 15. But they said, if you didn't have another bit that day, if you weren't working on something else, then your job was to sit there and write jokes all day for the same topic. Then if it was a celebrity list, so like on the last show, they have Chris Rock and Steve Martin and Alec Baldwin and Barbara Walters, all these huge stars.
Right.
Then not only do you have to have the head writer and Dave approve it, now you got to have the publicist, the agent, and then the star approve. So then there was all kinds of changes. Wow. So it really took up a huge amount of these writers' day just coming up with this top 10 list.
Absolutely. And let's talk about the challenges of booking a president of the United States on the show. What has to go into that kind of an appearance? And does that start, you know, weeks out or months out, and that whole process?
It honestly started a year out, if you can imagine. So as soon as Dave announced his retirement, Mike Buzinski, he was the booker for all the political guests. He actually started with the White House then, working on getting President Obama and the First Lady to be guests. And then as soon as CBS announced that May would be the last date, they went to the White House first and said, when can President Obama do this? Then when they do it, they have to bring the Secret Service in, and they block off an entrance, and none of the workers can go through there. And it was very interesting to, you know, because I would think if the president's in the building, I'm going to be really excited about it. But they were like, oh, it makes the day horrible. It's hard to go out for lunch. You might as well pack your lunch and stay up in the office. And those are the things you find out. But for these people, it was like going to an office anywhere else.
Right.
So there's a lot of interesting stories like that in the book.
What are some of the most surprising things that you learned from writing this book?
Well, I think what really surprised me the most was how much these people were loyal and protective of Dave. You know, when Dave gave the announcement that he was going to retire, and then they had a year. So these people knew that in a year they were out of a job, and they didn't jump ship. I mean, a few people did, but most people stayed there. And if you think about, I don't know if you worked at some factory, some widget factory, and you knew that you had 9 months left to pay, you're probably going to be putting your resume and out everywhere to make sure that you can support your family. And the one of the producers I talked to, he talked to all these interns, and he was like, guys, you got to get a job. Like, look around. And they didn't want to. They wanted to be there for the end. And that made me feel good, because, you know, that's how I felt about Letterman. But it was interesting that these people that worked for him also felt that way about him as well.
And I know a number of the staff had been with him for several decades, even many of them coming over from the NBC days too, right?
Correct. I mean, Barbara Gaines and Jude Brennan had been there since Dave was on the morning show, which was even before that. So since 1980. So some of them for 35 years, they had worked with him. One of the guys, Bill Sheff, who wrote the foreword for the book, he worked on the monologue, and he said when they did a top 10 list of long-running staffs, he had been with Dave for 22 years, and he wasn't even close to being able to be on the top 10, because that was a drop in the bucket for the people who had worked for him.
Do the staff and crew still stay in touch with Mr. Letterman?
Yes, they do. They meet up. I see pictures on social media, and the one time I had just interviewed someone, and then the next day they posted a picture of them having lunch with Dave, and I thought, did they mention the book? Are they talking about, did he say what he did the day before that he had talked to me? So that was kind of crazy, I feel like. Just because I didn't ask for Dave to be in the book. I was talking to these people and I figured if they mention it to Dave, it's a lot easier for Dave to get to me than it is for me to get to Dave.
Right. Well, so that was my next question is, has David Letterman read your book?
Well, I hope everyone in America has. I mean, haven't they? I don't know if Dave has read the book or not. I have not asked anyone. You know, I'm planning, we're going to do this thing in March at the 92nd Y, which is this event place in New York City about the last days of Letterman. And we're going to have some writers, the producer, the director of the show, and Barbara Gaines. And tickets are on sale now at the 92nd Y for an evening about Letterman. And so I am kind of in contact with them, but I don't have the nerve to ask them if Dave knows about the book. Just because, I mean, I know he knows about it, but if he's read it, and I don't know. I haven't heard, I haven't even asked them what they think about it. It's just not in my nature to get that kind of feedback. I don't look at internet comments. I just do my work and I put it out there and I let it fall where it may.
Well, I myself, I'm a longtime fan of David Letterman, and I hear that you are too. So I can imagine that just putting this book together and getting to talk with the longtime staffers like you did really was a special moment in time. And it's great that you've collaborated all of this information into one place that people can go and check out now.
Oh, it was such a dream. And when I'd be talking to these people, if I ever made them laugh, I would think, like, that's crazy. They made me laugh for years, and here I'm making them laugh. And so I never really got over it. I'm still not over it. I'm thinking, like, I'm going to sit on a panel with these giants. Like, this is going to be crazy, but I keep pretending.
Well, The Last Days of Letterman, the final 6 weeks, is available now for purchase, and it's also available in our catalog at cadl.org. Scott Ryan, thanks for joining us today.
Oh, thanks for having me on. And I love the library. I support libraries, and I'm just so excited to be on here and give the library some love.
Oh, we appreciate it. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
In 2011, our next guest wrote the book Aretha Franklin's Amazing Grace, 33 and a Third, a fascinating exploration of the best-selling gospel album of all time. Now, the long-buried concert film Amazing Grace is coming to theaters this year. Aaron Cohen, welcome to Cattlecast.
Well, thank you very, very much for having me.
Now, Amazing Grace marked Aretha Franklin's return to her gospel roots after she had already earned 11 consecutive number one pop and R&B singles, won 5 Grammy Awards, and released more than 20 albums. What made her go back to her roots and do these gospel songs?
Well, there were a lot of reasons for her to go back, personally, as well as a reason for Atlantic to release the record. On the personal level with Aretha Franklin, she had never left the church. She had always maintained ties to the church tradition. She had always been a regular at the church. And of course, her father, the Reverend C.L. Franklin, was a very prominent Baptist minister at that time. And so she was always engaged in that tradition, even if that's not what she was recording in the early and mid 1960s. There were a lot of things that were going on in terms of her family life, in terms of her mentors in the church, like Clara Ward, who was present during the recording. Clara Ward was from that earlier generation of gospel artists, as was Mahalia Jackson. And that earlier generation was on the way, they were sort of retreating from public view. In fact, that was not long before Mahalia Jackson's death. So I think for Aretha Franklin, there was maintaining, strengthening that tie to that earlier generation of gospel artists who she had grown up working with as a young girl, singing with, being a protege of. So I think that she was responding to that, passing the torch, as it were. There was also her reemergence in terms of thinking about black consciousness at that time because of the people she was with, like Ken Cunningham, who was her partner at that time, who was very much involved with the black arts movement in New York. At that time, with Reverend James H. Cone and other African-American theologians, there was a strength that gospel music was the pure black music, that it had been unadulterated from interaction with white influences. And I think Aretha Franklin was very strongly identifying with that, not just as a gospel performer, as a singer, but also when you look at the cover art of the album as well.
And what was the significance of the recording location of Amazing Grace? And we're talking about 1972?
January 1972. Let me also say at that time, and this goes back to the record's release, I was going to mention this earlier, but gospel is becoming significant crossover business as well. There was Oh Happy Day, the gospel crossover hit. There were songs like My Sweet Lord. There was the popular Jesus Christ Superstar musical. So Atlantic Records certainly knew that there was money to be made in gospel. So the producer, Jerry Wexler, was certainly amenable to, from a commercial standpoint, to Aretha's request to record this album. Now, to answer your question about the church, this was the New Temple Missionary Baptist Church in Watts. So the connection with her father's church was very strong. It was the same denomination. But also Watts at that time was certainly the heart of African-American Los Angeles. Certainly there was the Watts Uprising a few years earlier, and then shortly thereafter was the Watts Stax concert. So Watts, a church in Watts, especially an old traditional church in Watts, had a very strong tie to the surrounding African-American community. Also, Los Angeles was the home of the Reverend James Cleveland, who was a longtime friend and associate of Aretha's, who had also become a great innovator in terms of gospel choirs and the gospel choir tradition. So having James Cleveland in Los Angeles was certainly a part of it, as well as Aretha Franklin wanting to become involved in other aspects of arts entertainment industry, including film and television at that time.
Sure. Now, the film was originally directed by Sidney Pollack, but
yes,
there were some technical issues that caused the film to go unreleased.
Yes. The sound and images, the clapper, which would synchronize the sound and images, were not synchronized properly when the film was made. So that was one reason why it sat unreleased for many, many years, was because the technology did not exist to properly sync up the sound and image. I'm going to try to condense this very long, involved, complicated story, but in the 2000s, producer Alan Elliott was able to get the rights to the film footage, and he was able to use technology. He was able to use rely on very good editing, as well as lip syncing, as well as his own musical expertise to finish the film.
Wow, that's sounds like tedious work, but the end result, I'm sure, is amazing. And
let's just say it's very, very labor intensive work. I saw the raw footage. Alan was very kind to show me the raw footage when I started working on the book in 2009, and then I saw the finished version for the first time after I finished the book in 2011, and then I saw a version that came out, that's coming out now, and the technical work that went into it is just beyond belief.
And we should say that this is more than just a concert film. What are viewers going to see when they watch this?
What viewers will see, which of course they would know going into the film, was how magnificently Aretha Franklin sings. And they would also see that, but one of the things that they'll be very interested to see is that Aretha Franklin even though she had that reputation of being a diva, reputation of being a star performer, as the footage shows in the film, she was very happy to collaborate. She was happy to step back and listen to other people who would give direction. She was working as an equal with everyone. She was a team player, which is as important to any great artist as one's own individual accomplishment. So that comes out very strongly in the film. The film will also show how much a part of the community this performance was, how in the back and forth with her and the congregation and her father and her group, that this was a living community, that it wasn't some, you know, stage event where it was performer on stage separate from everyone else. Everybody was there together in so many senses of the word.
And you've talked a little bit about this, but how did this movie finally get released after all these years?
Well, again, I have to condense quite a lot because it's a very long, involved story. But Aretha Franklin, for various reasons, did not want it released at the time of Alan Elliott's involvement. After her passing, her niece, Sabrina Owens, who is in charge of her estate, agreed for the film to be released. And so with the blessing of Aretha Franklin's estate, all of those legal hurdles were cleared and they were able to bring it to theaters.
Well, I know people are going to enjoy seeing it, and as well as reading your book, too, with the behind the scenes of all of that. Now, we should also mention that you're working on a new book that comes out later this year. What can you share with us about this new title?
My next book is called Move On Up, Chicago Soul Music and Black Cultural Power. It is coming out this September from the University of Chicago Press, and it looks at the social and cultural forces here in Chicago that shaped soul music in the city primarily during the 1960s and 1970s, and also how the musicians themselves were direct change agents here in Chicago.
Very cool. We'll look forward to seeing that one, too.
Well, thank you very, very much.
The book Amazing Grace 33 and a Third is still available for purchase, and the film Amazing Grace will be in theaters very soon. Aaron Cohen, thanks for joining us today.
Well, thank you so very much for having me.
And that wraps up another Cattlecast podcast. I'm Mark Bezita. Thanks for joining us. See you next time.